This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. The characters in Chitra Banerjee Devakaruni's new novel, The Mistress of Spices, straddle two worlds, modern-day Oakland, California, and the traditional culture of their native India. Second-generation Indian girls resist their parents' attempts to arrange marriages for them with suitable men from the old country. Battered wives stay with their husbands because if they left, there'd be no place for them in the tight social circles of Indian immigrant society. Chitra Banerjee Devakaruni knows this territory well. She was born in a village near Calcutta and emigrated to America when she was 19. She's the author of several books of poetry and a collection of short stories called Arranged Marriages. She also helped found and is now president of Maitri, a support group for South Asian women. The title of her first novel, The Mistress of Spices, refers to the main character, Tilo. Tilo is a woman who learned on a mythic island to weave magic with spices and who runs a spice store in Oakland. Here, Chitra Banerjee Devakaruni reads a short passage from her novel about one common Indian spice, turmeric.
When I hold it in my hands, the spice speaks to me. Its voice is like evening, like the beginning of the world. I am turmeric who rose out of the ocean of milk when the devas and asuras churned for the treasures of the universe. I am turmeric who came after the poison and before the nectar, and thus lie in between.
Now, you wrote somewhere that for this book you dipped into the language and the imagery of your childhood in India. Did you mean the language from childhood books or stories, or is this how your mother or your aunts or your nannies talked sometimes?
A little of both. I think it's the language of the stories that were told to me when I was little. It's the language of those folk tales and those mythical tales that my grandfather told me and my mother told me and old women in the neighborhood would tell children. And I wanted to go back to this language when I fashioned this tale, which I think of as a mythical fable for our modern times.
Now, how much lore about spices and their significance did you know growing up in India?
I knew a fair amount because spices are such a big part of our everyday life. Not only are they used for cooking, but they're used for all kinds of home remedies. And they're also used for all kinds of spiritual or maybe I should say superstitious purposes, you know, to avert bad luck, to take away the evil eye and things of that kind. So I grew up with a fair amount of that.
What kind of home remedies?
Well, as in the section that I wrote, that I read just now, turmeric is used for skin problems, especially for young women. I grew up for years every day rubbing turmeric into my skin.
And how do you look now?
Well, my mother would say I look much better than I would have if I hadn't.
Now, did you believe in the magical uses of spices?
Well, the magical uses of spices are kind of based on some of the other things that I read, like the spiritual nature of the spices, how they're good luck. And when, for example, when you go into a new home, you'll use certain spices. Turmeric is one of them. When a baby is born in the house, you use certain spices. So to me, that seemed like a really magical kind of thing. And of course, when you read the ancient Ayurvedic texts, and I did some Ayurvedic research when I started writing the book, I was aware also that the spices have certain spiritual properties that are supposed to be associated with each. And then I have to confess, I freely made things up whenever I felt I needed to.
Now, Tilo, the main character, is part shaman and part wise old woman storekeeper. Did you model her on someone you know, or was she more a part of a long tradition in Indian folklore of women who spin magic with spices?
I think she's part of that old folklore, the wise women characters who are healers and who help younger people. But I think she is also a very personal part of me because it seems to me that in some ways her story is the quintessential immigrant story of a person who comes to a new culture with all of this heritage, this rich weight of heritage in some ways, and has to decide what to keep and what to give away.
Well, one problem that you deal with in this book and in your short stories too is that the more you get involved with America and American life, the more an immigrant assimilates, the more you're saying to the people in your family who remain true to their traditions that this way is better than the old way, that this way is better than staying loyal to the old country. And it's such a tragic dilemma because in order to survive, you might have to betray these ones that you love.
Yes, I think Thilo feels that very powerfully. And, you know, it's a wrench right in her heart because on the one hand, she loves the island and everything it stands for. She loves her teacher. And yet she cannot, in some ways, not respond to the call of America. And I think one of the things I was trying to say maybe through the book is once you've chosen to come to a new country, in some ways you've already chosen to be involved in that country, to be transformed by that country, and to transform it. And that's what the Mistress of Spices does and becomes.
One of the dilemmas that you write about in this book and also in your short stories is the dilemma between accepting the tradition of arranged marriages in Indian culture or choosing to marry for love. And you have one character in The Mistress of Spices, Geeta, who decides she's fallen in love with a Chicano man, and she cuts her hair. She does all sorts of things to alienate her parents and her grandfather, and they disown her. As a young girl, I'm curious, did you believe you would pick your own husband? Or did you believe your parents would choose a husband for you?
Well, when I was in India as a young woman, I came here when I was 19. So I think before I left India, I was very much attuned to the idea of arranged marriages. That was what most of my friends were doing. And I kind of saw that as a way of life. Well, when I came to America, I started getting other ideas of my own that were quite disconcerting to my parents, too, just like Geeta. And then I think ultimately I did meet my husband over here and we decided to arrange our own marriage. And then we had to do a lot of talking to my mother as well.
How prevalent are arranged marriages still in India?
Arranged marriages are very popular and I have to say very successful for the most part. I would say 70 to 75% of people have arranged marriages, especially in the rural areas. This number is even higher. And what's really interesting is there's a high percentage of arranged marriages among Indian Americans here. Even the second and third generation often choose to have arranged marriages. And this was very interesting to me when I started researching this.
Now, your parents, was their marriage arranged?
You know, what is really interesting is my parents' marriage was not arranged. They kind of ran away and got married. And so it was very ironic to me when my mother was so insistent that I should have an arranged marriage. But I think looking back at it, I understand because she had to face so much social opposition because of her marriage that she wanted to make sure I wouldn't have that same problem.
And by social opposition, does that mean she was considered an outcast, or how did people treat
her? Very much, very much. Her family was very opposed to it. She came from a village, so like the entire village for years, I mean, they looked at her as someone who had betrayed her culture.
Now, is the arranged marriage system very much tied up in the caste system in that your mother betrayed her family and brought shame upon them because she's not perpetuating her caste and her level, her place in society?
To some extent, the arranged marriage is based on caste, especially if it's a traditional family. I think in the case of my mother, it was more that she decided, she gave in to passion, and she decided to make her own choice. And that itself would be shame enough in a family, in a traditional family like she was brought up in.
You say your mother was ostracized. What about your father?
Well, as in Western society, there is a double standard for men and women. And I think it's more pronounced in the traditional Eastern societies. So it was okay for my father. I mean, he wasn't regarded as, you know, the hero, but he was at least not looked down upon because it was okay for him as a man to follow his passions, but it was not okay for my mother as a woman. Because I think in the traditional families, often women were seen as the ones who upheld the virtue of the family and upheld the culture of the society. And so that was their responsibility.
Now, you didn't choose this path, but you've said that you believe arranged marriage is a valid way to go about it. By valid, do you mean that you believe the odds of the marriage being a happy one are just about the same as in a marriage made for love?
I think the arranged marriage has a great chance of succeeding and does succeed because of a number of reasons. If it is done in a positive way, and I think today most arranged marriages are being conducted in a way that allow the young people a lot of say, and they can say no if the family is arranging a marriage with someone that they don't like. I think once they have that choice, the arranged marriage does have several positive aspects, and one of them is it's a combined decision with family, and often our parents know us much more than we would like to admit they do.
I'm curious what you think the problems of marrying for love are.
Well, I think there are so many. Where can we start? No, I think the major problem is that often when we marry for love, we do it impulsively and we do it with great expectations from our partner. We have these enormous expectations in our head of what our partner should be to us. I think the strong point of arranged marriage is it's a relationship that starts with little expectation and therefore it can grow from there easily. But we expect our partner to be kind of everything to us in a romantic marriage. And often, and I can say this looking at my own marriage, we don't realize that in marriage, no matter what kind of marriage it is, a success comes from working at it, adjusting, being considerate, being loving, which is different sometimes from being romantic.
Chitra Banerjee Divakaruni is my guest. She's a poet and a short story writer. Now she's written her first novel. It's called The Mistress of Spices. She's also the president of Maitri, a support hotline for South Asian women suffering from domestic violence or other problems. And we're going to be talking about that a little bit later. We're going to take a short break now, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with writer Chitra Banerjee Divakaruni. Her new novel is The Mistress of Spices. Right before you wrote this book, The Mistress of Spices, you, I think, is this right? You almost died in childbirth?
That's correct. I had a cesarean, and then everything went wrong with it. Everything got infected. I had to have more surgery. And it was a very stressful time of my life because my baby had to be taken away from me. I couldn't take care of him. So for about a month, I really thought I was going to die.
What did you try to incorporate out of that experience into the writing?
I think I wanted to create a sense of how the lines we draw between life and death, you know, they seem so rigid in our everyday life when we think about life and we think about death. But when I was in that state of near death, it seemed like a very fluid state. And there were days when it seemed to me that it was possible to move back and forth between those states and between those existences, and that indeed we had many lifetimes that we lived, and this was just one of them. And I wanted to create a world which was a mythic world of that kind, where such things could happen. And I think I wanted very much to dissolve boundaries in this book, not just between life and death, between realism and magic, but also between communities and between people. That was very important.
When I've heard other people talk about near-death experiences, they often say, you know, that's how it felt then, but I can barely remember it. It really seems to fade away from me, and it's very hard for me to hold on to the experience and the emotions and the insights I had. I wondered if that happened to you, too, and is writing about dissolving boundaries or about what you're talking about, is that a way of giving this amazing experience staying power in your life?
Yes, absolutely. And even now as I talk to you, I am remembering the experience, but it's much diluted. And I can't even put into words how it really was. It was a very powerful and, what shall I say, liberating kind of experience where when you realize that life is as beautiful as death and death is as meaningful as life. And it's very hard to hold on to that. But I think writing was a way for me to try and put it into words, into metaphor, let's say. That's what I was trying to do.
You've helped found and are now president of Maitri, and that's a helpline for women from Southeast Asia. What motivated you to start the group?
I helped start Maitri in 1991, and it was the first service of that kind for South Asian women on the West Coast. What had happened is for years I'd been involved with mainstreamed battered women's shelters. I'd been volunteering for a number of years, and what I would see is that very few South Asian women ever came to these shelters, and even if they came, they would leave almost immediately. And so I could see that they were not comfortable talking to people who were cultural strangers or moving out of their homes, even when they were in abusive situations, into an environment that was very strange and very different from what they were used to. And yet from living in the community here in the Bay Area for more than 15 years, I knew, I could see that there was a need. I would hear stories often after the woman had passed through a lot of difficulty and a lot of distress. So a group of friends, we got together and we decided that there was a real need to start this society. And Maitri, the word Maitri means friendship, and that's what we are. We extend friendship to these women. We try to be a bridge between them and mainstream organizations that can help them. And also, we try to be a substitute for the extended families and the extended support systems that immigrant women have often left behind.
Many of these women are battered by their husbands and sometimes even by their in-laws. How does domestic violence play itself out differently in South Asian immigrant culture? And I'm thinking beyond even language barriers, that must play a role.
Yes, I think what I have noticed is that battering is a phenomena that is across cultures. My work with mainstream battered women's shelters showed me that there is no more of it in terms of percentage going on in South Asia. But I think what happens is often it's considered a great shame, and therefore the woman will not come out and acknowledge or complain or let people know what's happening. So she lives under this veil of silence. And often she is made to feel that it's probably something that's her fault. She did something wrong. And again, this last part is very similar to how a battered woman from mainstream American society often feels. So what I've noticed over the years as I've worked with battered women are really the similarities rather than the difference. But one big difference is that since the marriage is arranged by family, the woman feels obligated to her birth family to stay in the marriage and make it successful.
There's so much more of an investment then in the marriage?
That's right. And also there's often a situation where if there are several sisters and the first sister's marriage doesn't work out, then people will be reluctant to marry into that family again.
Oh, so you're carrying the burden of your relatives.
Yes. Often women will come to us and say, but you know, how can I do this? I still have sisters and cousins who are left to be married and I would just be ruining their chances. How can I leave my husband?
If you had stayed in India or gone back there after your graduate work here in this country, do you think you would have ended up a writer?
You know, that's a really interesting question because I think of that from time to time. I would like to believe that writing was deep inside me as a seed and I would become a writer, but I have no way of knowing. I'm positive that I would be a very different kind of writer, though, because I think America has really made me into a writer. And what I mean by that is America gave me first, for the first time in my life, the sense of being the other, being someone from the outside. In India, I grew up with many kinds of challenges, but I was always one of the mainstream. And it was only after I came here that I felt how it was to be an outsider. And that gave me a whole different vision into this society, as well as into India. Because the other thing that happened when I moved here, and I think this is true of many immigrants, is that I became an outsider in Indian society as well. I couldn't ever go back and be the same.
Was that a wrenching realization for you?
It was. It was very wrenching, especially in the early days where I felt I didn't belong here and I didn't belong there and I had no place. But I have since then come to feel that for a writer, that's not a bad thing to be, because that does give you a greater clarity of vision than when you're immersed in a culture and you're identifying totally with it.
You know, I really enjoyed talking with you, Ona. Thank you, Chitra, for talking with me today on Fresh Air.
You're most welcome. It was a pleasure for me.
Chitra Banerjee Divakaruni's new novel is The Mistress of Spices. This is Fresh Air.